Romeo India Whiskey. And Whiskey K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, Mel. Both Vic and Mel, try to orchestrate a thing called the Technical Man. The major purpose of the Technical Man is education and a little bit of entertainment sneaks in. We amateurs gather once per week and we teach each other some of the nuances, the technical details of this fairly complicated hobby called ham radio. By now you found out that there's a lot more to it than first meets the eye. We try to inform each one how antennas work and how transmitters work and how to make them work better and why does my feed line behave that way and why does propagation behave that way? Why does Mother Nature teach radio treat radio waves that way? We try to find these things out. There are approximately 26 different kinds of ham radio. FM 2 meter ham radio that you're listening to right now is just one of the 26 kinds. From time to time, we delve into the other 25 and try to tell people what they're missing because they haven't tried some of the other 25. There's a lot to it. An extremely educational hobby. If you want to learn electrical engineering, and particularly wireless engineering, there may be no faster way to do it than through the hobby of ham radio. And gatherings like this one, if we're successful. The schools and the books only do a partial job of teaching wireless technology. If you really want to know how radio works, talk to a ham radio operator. Learn how to design an antenna, same thing. So, this is where some of it happens, and Mel and I try to help that along. The majority of what takes place on the technical net is live questions and answers that people bring to the net. The major subject discussed on the technical net is the subjects you bring as questions. Once in a while, Mel will have a prepared program on things like how do you understand decibels or how do you understand a Smith chart. But for the most part, the subjects are the subjects that you bring. So, to a certain degree, it's your show. Mel does answer a small number of what he believes are worthy written questions, but that's not the major purpose.
Repeater, time out.
As I started saying, that's not the major purpose of this net. This is not intended to be a free written consulting service. For people who haven't yet got their ham license, and they want to know something about the hobby and where to go from here, a letter to Mel can quite possibly help you. But other than that, you want your question answered. You've got to sign in or have someone help you sign in with your question live. That's the major way we do the work. For a whole lot of reasons. I, for one, I'm a slow typer. And also I've discovered that when a person writes down a question, quite often the words he uses will lead you into an entirely different subject than the one that he thinks he's asking. Whereas with a give and take that takes place with live verbal communication, I rapidly find out what the person, I rapidly find out what my misinterpretation was of the person's question. And so we get on something a heck of a lot faster. A lot of time is saved. So for economy, among other reasons, it has to be a live show. That's where the majority of it is. If you've got a question or a comment for the net, please sign in tonight and give Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, W-H-R-Y-Y, Joe and yes. So do we have any questions or comments? Give me a call letter and name right now, K2RIW.
K2RSO, Frank, yes.
One personal.
Okay, I heard Frank, RSO, and I heard someone say personal. Please give me a call letter and name again.
That's Bob, W2OSR, Dick. I've got a personal question and a technical question.
Okay. We'll let you have. Mr. Secretary, you're allowed to ask two questions if you so desire. Okay, Frank and Bob so far. Anyone else?
KB2JXN with the quickie.
JXN? When you say quickie, JXN, is that because you're about to drive out of the area?
It's a distinct possibility. I had to drive a half an hour to talk to you last week, and I waited an hour and nothing happened. I had to drive home again.
Okay, since you signed in last week and we didn't get to you, that puts you number one on the runway this week. Please tell me your name, sir.
Gary.
Okay, Gary. All righty. So far we've got Frank, Bob, Gary. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
K2KYQ, Joe, and no.
Okay, Joe with an O. And another extremely weak station. One more call. Anyone else who signed in for the TechNet with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now.
WHYY. Yes.
Okay, we got Joe with a yes. I thought we would eventually. Okay, Gary, KB2JXN, who signed in last week. Go right ahead with your question.
Okay, this is in regard to my tri-bander antenna that you wanted to let you guys know about the outcome of that. We spoke about this twice before. This was an antenna that happened to me. I had intermittent SWRs on it. It's a GP15 capacitor exploded on it. One of the guys suggested I drill a hole into it and put out of the gimmick wires into it. I finally found out by trial and error what, trying different capacitors, which ones was the ideal one, and it turned out to be 15 picofarads, and I put in a higher voltage cap that I could possibly fit in there. And that's about it. In the beginning, initially, when we spoke all about this, we were also talking about three different coax lengths that I was using. So I just stuck with the one coax length and did all my SWR checks, trying all the different capacitors with that. So that's just a comment or a remark that you were interested in, so I wanted to tell you that last week. My question for this week is, if you're going to buy an antenna and you got a spec sheet for this thing and they say minimum SWR is 1.5 to 1, what coax length do they use?
Yeah, I think I see. Glad you were able to do that repair. And it sounds like you've got it working again, Gary. When a manufacturer tells you the standing wave ratio of the antenna, if he's telling you the truth, he's telling you what standing wave ratio at the antenna. Standing wave ratio comes about because the antenna is something other than 50 ohms as a pure resistor. And therefore, a 50 ohm coax cable doesn't have the ability to deliver all of its power to that antenna, and some of it becomes reflected. And because the power has to go up through the cable to hit the antenna, and then whatever reflected power comes back and goes through the insertion loss of the cable a second time, the standing wave ratio with good instrumentation that you'll measure in the shack is always lower than it is at the antenna. So, if the manufacturer is telling you the truth, he's telling you the VISWR of the antenna itself, independent of the transmission line. And for him to make that measurement, if he's telling you the truth, he is either making the measurement at the antenna, or he knows the real insertion loss of his cable, he knows how to mathematically crank out the improvement in standing wave ratio you get in the shack, and therefore he can calculate what it must have been right at the antenna. So if any manufacturer is giving you a VISWR in the shack, assuming some particular length of cable, and he's doing a kind of chicanery. He's doing something that's dishonest. I'd like to believe they're not doing that. When it comes to the gain numbers that are in the specifications or in the advertisements that used to exist, many manufacturers fib quite a bit on the gain numbers. And are they still doing it now that QST will not accept gain numbers because of so much falsehood going on? That's a darn good question. But I think you're on the standing wave ratio numbers. I think you're in good shape on the wind load and the pounds of weight and the pounds of wind loading and so on. So back to you, Gary. KB2JX, Mike, JXM, K2RIW, listening. You got it, Gary.
Okay, thank you. I had to ask that because I've done some of those experiments myself with antennas. And by putting the SWR meter right at the antenna itself, I got some really high readings. So I don't know how this guy got 1.5 to 1 when I can't even get close to that.
With the right kind of instrumentation, though, Gary, you can find out not only is your standing wave ratio, let me pick a number, 1.9 to 1, when he claims 1.5, but with the right kind of instrumentation, you can find out it's either higher than 50 ohms or lower than 50 ohms, or it's got some simultaneous inductive reactants or some simultaneous capacitive reactants. And with that right instrumentation telling you exactly what is the real mistuning of the antenna, it would give you some pretty strong hints as to make the capacitor bigger or smaller, make the length longer or shorter, or so on. There's ways you can find that out. So if you want to invest the time and go through the effort of the learning process, you can either do it with better instrumentation that really tells you the real impedance, a noise bridge, for instance, or you can find it by trial and error, by making, say, for instance, you're on 15 meters, and you take the 15-meter portion of the antenna and take that driven element and make it longer or shorter, or add a small capacitor at the feed point, or a small inductor at the feed point. By trial and error, you can find out which direction you have to go in order to make it better, if you want to. Now, you don't absolutely have to. As bad as a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio sounds, and many a transmitter will complain and cut back in its power output and go into the self-protect mode and whatever, if you can keep your transmitter running with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, that only represents a half a decibel of potential loss if you didn't correct it with an antenna tuner. You could also add an antenna tuner or build your own antenna tuner. So even as bad as a 2-to-1 sounds, a half a dB of loss is 1/12 of a S meter reading, you know, S8 versus S9, on a well-calibrated S meter. Rarely is that going to make the difference between a QSO or a non-QSO. So we got to be careful not to over-catastrophize numbers like that. Now, if you've got a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio, yeah, you've got something really bad and you want to correct it. But a 1.9-to-1, if your transmitter is happy, and maybe you can make it happy by putting the right length of transmission line, add an extra random length between the feed line and the transmitter, and your particular transmitter may turn out to be happy with a 1.9 and turn out the full 100 watts.
Repeater, timeout.
As crazy as that sounds, that's still a workable condition, as you can see, Gary. So there's various ways you can make some more measurements, find out what's going on, and find out how bad it really is. KB2JXM, K2LIW.
KEY, what comments?
I'll recognize that. Gary first, go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Dick. With your last transmission, you brought up something that I was going to ask about. I just can't remember what it was right now.
Okay, let's let Mel give us his comment, and then maybe you'll think of it. K2KEY, go right ahead, Mel.
Yes, what I've done lately, I have looked into a number of new pieces of equipment that I own and also some of my friends own, and I wanted to see what happens when you start raising the standing waves. And I found that most of the rigs that even have built-in antenna tuners, that when you get beyond 2-to-1, that the antenna tuner built in seems to have almost little or no effect. It just folds back the power and does not seem to be able to compensate for your higher SWR at the antenna terminals. So what I suggest to everybody is basically use an external, good, old-fashioned, manually tuned tuner. And you'll tune the antenna system, and everything will work fairly well, and you could really tolerate SWRs, like you say, of 3-to-1, 4-to-1, and still make the rig happy, and you will work out just as well. You'll have really no problem with loss of signal, but the difference is that now you'll have a rig that's being satisfied, and of course you're also, to some extent, retuning the antenna for any compensation. So this suggestion seems to have worked quite well with most everybody that has basically given me the same complaint, Dick, over.
Very fine, Mel. Good information. If your feed line is low enough in loss, and most of us can afford some pretty good feed line these days, it doesn't have to be extremely expensive, you can make the choice of either making a perfect impedance match at the antenna itself, or 90-some-odd percent of the time, you can do the impedance matching in the shack with adding an antenna tuner. That's the sophisticated approach. Put that in between the rig and the antenna feed line. Or with enough study in knowing what exact impedance your antenna is presenting to the transmitter in the shack, you have the ability to put on stub tuners, just a simple piece of T connector and coax cable of the right length, and make some tremendous improvements of the impedance that your antenna presents to the transmitter. Make the transmitter happy, maybe give you a little bit more linearity and a little bit more fidelity out of the rig, and a little bit more power ultimately transmitted. You don't have to absolutely do all the impedance matching right at the antenna. Sometimes the antenna is not a convenient place to get to. So building your own antenna tuner is a very worthwhile project if you want to build. Buying one is a little on the pricey side if you buy a really good one that's running at high power, but an awful nice thing to own that allows you to correct for a lot of sins. With an antenna tuner with enough range to it, every random length of wire that you throw out the window, so to speak, most of the time you can make it work with a really good wide-range antenna tuner. That's how they used to do it on the so-called NZ ZEP antennas, just a random hunk of wire hanging out of the Zeppelin. That's the way they used to communicate. That's where the NZ ZEP came from. Let's see if Gary thought of the other question he had. KB2JXM, K2RIW.
You can get back to me, Dick. I just brought up a very interesting subject.
Okay. Gary first. Go ahead, Gary.
Okay, thank you. Thanks a lot. Now you might want to get up on the mic a little bit. Let's see. Oh, yeah, okay. I remember now. The antenna tuner. Okay, I had a question about that. A friend of mine on 28 megahertz is using an antenna tuner. So I'm thinking to myself, okay, now what is this thing really doing? Are you just tuning the coax throughout the whole system, or are you just tuning the portion from the transmitter to the matchbox such that that's 1-to-1, and then from the matchbox to the antenna is still 3-to-1?
Yeah. The majority of the answer is your second. In other words, if the antenna is giving you a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, and if you've got a certain number of dB of loss of the cable so that you see a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio in the shack, the antenna tuner does not correct the 3-to-1 at the antenna or the 2-to-1 at the feed line. And yes, it does make the input to the antenna tuner look like a 1-to-1 as far as the transmitter is concerned. As bad as that sounds, that's still good. The transmitter is happy, it puts out full power. If the feed line is low enough in loss, the fact that the feed line is running with a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio at one end is not necessarily bad. There's a curve you can find in the transmission line section of the antenna engineering handbook. No, the ARL antenna book. The ARL antenna book has got a curve that'll show you, it's a graph, that once you know the matched loss of your cable, maybe your particular length of cable on your particular band, 100 feet of RG so-and-so coax happens to have 1 dB of loss. And because your antenna has a 3-to-1 VISWR, even with the antenna tuner, the feed line, because the signal is bouncing back and forth between the antenna tuner and the antenna, that 1 dB of loss is going to have another, let's say, 3/10 of dB, and you go up to 1.3 altogether. That's not a showstopper. But there's a curve that'll allow you to figure that one out. So you can talk to the guys, they'll tell you a real horror story that if your antenna has got a 3-to-1 VISWR, there's just no way in hell you're going to live with that if you don't correct it. Well, that's an opinion. That's an extremely severe opinion that 99% of the time is not accurate. You'd be amazed how many times guys have done a very good correction job at the antenna tuner in the shack for a pretty lousy antenna and worked very well. A particular multiband antenna I used to use on 20 meters had a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio, but I still made QSOs with it. I bet you Mel's done things like that. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, very good, Dick. Oops. Back on you? Okay. It'll duck for a second. What happens I had a question. What happened to this? Let me remember the question. Yes. There's one of the guys said that in Germany this, the company is marketing an antenna tuner that he sees. They said it's superior to the ones that are marketed in this country. Most of the antenna tuners that they're marketing, you see in the QSC, is based on Lou McCoy's design of the ultimate transmatch using a pi network type of device. You know, a capacitor on the in, and then an inductor to ground, whether it's fixed, tapped inductor or for different bands or rotary, and then a capacitor that I consider to the output portion of the tuner. There's one that's being marketed in Europe that uses a rotary inductor on the in, then a variable capacitor to ground, and then a rotary inductor on the out to the output, to the out terminal. What do you think? Does that sound like using two inductors is superior to one inductor instead of using two variables, one inductor? Which would you think would work better? Because I've been asked this question. I don't know. I really don't know if it makes much a difference, even. Over.
Thank you, sir. Okay, did you say something, Gary?
Yes, I just want to thank you for your answer. I have to get back in the house now. Thanks for your answer, and I'll be QRT over here.
Okay, Gary, too bad you don't have a handy talkie where you can continue to listen, because we're going to continue talking about your subject a little bit more. When you study the manuals on impedance matching, Mel, there's a zillion ways of doing it. A capacitor, inductor, capacitor, a so-called pi network, is a very popular one. There's also an even slightly larger range antenna tuner, which is called a pi L. It's got a pi network followed by an L network. As you add these extra doodads with extra tuning, you cover a larger and larger percentage of the Smith chart where your impedance falling somewhere in the good area, you can bring it all the way to the center of the chart by properly tuning. Now, should your antenna tuner be a pi or a T? And you can make a T network out of series capacitor, shunt inductor, series capacitor. You can make it out of series inductor, shunt capacitor, series inductor. So a T network, a TL, a pi L, you're really building a kind of a ladder network. The ultimate network is sort of what's really going on inside of the transmission line. The transmission line is a zillion infinitesimal sections of a ladder network, where you've got shunt capacitors and series inductors on the line if you were doing it with twin lead. And as you make any of those variables large enough in range, you can tune anything. Now, to say that one is better than the other is a matter of what is most popular and what is the easiest to physically implement. The pi network is extremely popular because it's got a lot of range. It's easy to implement. Every one of these antenna tuners, no matter whether you build it as a T, a pi, a pi L, a TL, whatever, if you've used low enough loss components, the antenna tuner itself will match the impedances going in and out, make them compatible with each other, and operate with essentially zero insertion loss. A well-shielded antenna tuner, no matter what topography it's got, if you're putting a kilowatt into it and you run it for 10 solid minutes, it should run ice cold, and down close to a kilowatt is going to come out and go up the feed line. So is one better than the other? That's a matter of your personality, your ability to calculate what the inductors and capacitors...
Repeater, timeout.
It's partially a function of your previous experience with tuning networks. There's a lot of ways of doing impedance matching, and it's very hard to say that one is better than the other. Pi is the most popular. I'm having trouble believing... Well, I will admit that if you've got an inductor, capacitor, inductor, that T network that you described, and those inductors are inductuners, rotary inductuners, where you can make them go everything from one turn to 10 turns of a great big inductor, as far as tuning range is concerned, because you've got more total variables involved, you may have a greater percentage of the Smith chart that you can cover. That's the good news. But rotary variable inductor type inductors give you a problem. When they're brand new and they're silver plated, they work like a charm. But 2 years downrange, if you tune them a lot and you've scraped away all of the silver plating and now you're down to the bare brass, which is oxidizing, I'm not convinced you're going to get as high an efficiency with that kind of a tuner. Whereas a well-built PI network with a fixed inductor or an inductor that's got a rotary switch where you can shunt out a certain number of turns or select a certain number of turns, and you got a well-made transmitting type variable capacitors, if it's well-constructed, that could give you a lot of service for decades or more with essentially no problems. So I worry about the variable inductor type giving you some trouble after you scrape away the silver plating. That's one of my opinions on the subject, Mel. Let's see if you've got any further ones on it. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, I can only go by experience. I have a Collins rig, Collins KWS1, that uses a rotary inductor built in, part of the PI network tuning, and two variable capacitors. Basically, what you go out and have to spend hundreds of extra dollars for today is built into that rig. The rig was built in 1957. Collins built the KWS1. They were a little pricey for their days. Be equivalent today to a rig. I'm trying to equate about that time or price compared today. About $20,000 today would cost you for that same rig. So the component quality was excellent. The rig still performs 100%. It's been tuned and retuned many a time. I have a couple of rotary inductors type tuners, and I've never had any problems. The only thing I've ever seen on them is some tarnish that will develop. And just cleaning them up with just a eraser, basically just a rubber eraser, has been able to restore them. So I haven't had any problem with any rotary inductor type tuners or transmitters that have them in them. But I don't know. I was just saying to myself, gee, I have not seen that type of commercial. Of course, I've dealt with a number of my own L networks. You name it, all kinds of tuning systems I've got here, quite a number of them. I've got a number of home-built rotary inductors. I have home-built variable capacitors and all kinds of things that I designed specifically for my particular need or experiment. But I have never seen that commercially, a PI network that uses two rotary inductors and a variable capacitor instead of a variable capacitor. Two variable capacitors and a rotary inductor, the other way around, Dick. So that's why I asked for your opinion. Go ahead.
Yeah, the good news about Collins and their ability to make very high-quality components is I'll bet you they used two or three times the thickness of silver plating of anyone else, in which case it's quite possible that you can clean it a whole lot of times with the right kind of cleaning technique and not rub away all the silver plating. There are less diligent manufacturers, though, that have made rotary inductors where the silver plating can be worn away. I think there was a rotary inductor on the ARC 5 transmitters, the World War II airborne transmitters, which some people have thought are built with a lot of quality, and some of them have run into some wear-out problems. So whether you switch the inductance and tune the capacitance or vice versa, there's pros and pros and cons to each one, but in any case, every method, every topography of an antenna tuner is going to cover a certain amount of the Smith chart, and the LCL technique that you just described, I'm going to call it a T-network, it's going to cover about the same area as a PI, in my opinion, but a slightly different portion of the Smith chart, but that's not necessarily good or bad. Even if my particular antenna is so bad that it falls into the area where my antenna tuner cannot thoroughly correct it. In many cases, you add another random length of coax cable between your antenna tuner and your feed line. That rotates you, so to speak, to another portion of the Smith chart where now quite possibly your antenna tuner can handle it. There's a lot of ways of solving the problem. Or you can put one more T connector with a stub tuner in front of your antenna tuner, again, to give you more range. So there's a lot of ways of fixing it. You don't necessarily have to climb the tower. but all of these techniques properly carried out should run ice cold by the laws of conservation of energy. If your transmitter is putting out 100 watts, most of that 100 watts is going to be delivered to the feed line, and even if the antenna has a medium-high standing wave ratio, like 3 to 1 or less, as long as your feed line is low enough in loss, you're going to deliver most of that power to the antenna, which is going to radiate into space. Your next problem is to worry about how high is the antenna? Does it have a big enough ground plane under it? If you followed Mel and Dick's advice, you're going to be setting up vertical half-wave dipoles and feeding them either at the bottom or in the center. It's an antenna that's been thoroughly uninvestigated, and what little bit of experimentation has taken place with that antenna, even though it doesn't appear in any of the books as a recommendation, it still has an awful lot to offer and doesn't require 32 crown plane radials. Just a half-wave dipole of wire strung in the tree, as long as your tree is high enough that you can suspend a half-wave length of wire. And it doesn't have to be purely vertical. You can even slant it over at a 45-degree angle. A sloper, the people who have put up slopers have got some very nice things to say about them. This subject of antennas, antenna tuners, feed lines, and VisWire antennas, we're going to be discussing that to some degree many years to come. Highly misunderstood, a lot of different ways of solving the problem, a lot of ways of interpreting it. So don't be surprised if you hear more of that one. Let's go over to Frank. Frank, I've written down your call letters as K2RSO, Romeo Sierra Oscar. I don't think I've got that right, but you're going to correct me, Frank, and proceed with your question. K2RIW, my name is Dick. You got it, Frank.
K2RIW, here is N2RSO, and good evening, Dick. Good evening, Mel. Good evening, everyone else on the net tonight. The question I had this evening is a battery-related question. If you recall, a few weeks ago, we were talking about the Buddy Pole antenna and the Buddy Pole website. Let me see if I still have it.
You sure do, Frank. And now I get your call that is correct. So go ahead and give us the one-star point of view. You got it, Frank.
Okay, Dick. I was curious to go back to that Buddy Pole website, since I hadn't visited for a while, and I see that, which by the way is www.buddypole.com, but on the left is menus under accessories and portable power. It seems that he's selling custom manufactured nanophosphate battery packs, which are, I believe, a new chemical composition for lithium-ion rechargeable battery packs. They're manufactured by a company called A, as in Alpha, 123. And he sells three different types of batteries. So the first one is, well, it's only a 9-volt battery pack. The other two are rated 13.2 volts, and the first one is has a capacity of 2.3 amp hours. The other one has 4.6 amp hours. I was wondering if you or Mel or anyone else on the net can expand on this nanophosphate lithium-ion technology. Back to you, Dick, and to RSO.
Okay. I don't know about nanophosphate battery technology, and quite possibly somebody who will sign in does. It's obvious that when it comes to portable equipment running on batteries, handheld and whatever, or people that are doing roving with ham radio, continuous and tremendous investigation in batteries, having more ampere hours per pound and more watt hours per dollar, and more compact size and more charge-discharge cycles, you're going to be hearing a lot of battery technology improvements going on continuously to run electric automobiles as well as portable equipment. So it's not going to stop. And assuming the manufacturer is telling you the truth, and one of those batteries is good for 4 ampere hours, 4 amps at 13 volts is around 50 watts. So you can get 50 watts out of that battery for a solid hour is one way of looking at it. If you're running a 100-watt rig that runs at 50% efficiency, and for 200 watts you can put into it, it's kind of obvious you're not going to get a lot of hours of service out of a 80-to-10-meter 100-watt rig with a 4-ampere-hour battery. But on many of these batteries, you can put them in parallel. Like you can use more cells. But to try to store enough electrical energy, one way of doing it, of course, is to have the storage in the form of gasoline that runs a generator. If you're running a portable operation on a field day, that gives you a lot of power in a small package, because petroleum has got a lot of joules of energy in each gallon of gasoline, 120,000 BTUs approximately. And to do that with batteries would be very, very difficult. But batteries are required when it comes to standby power for things like an uninterruptible power supply. Let's see what I'm going to turn it over to the net and see if anyone has any further information about nano phosphate batteries run by the Buddy Pole Company. Give us your call letters and your name if you've got further information. KQIW listening. Doesn't look like we've got anybody with any further questions or any further information on that one, Frank. Doesn't completely surprise me, but as we read the good books on the subject, any of these battery technologies, eventually you can read not only data sheets from the manufacturer, but you'll eventually read an article about it in Science Magazine or Scientific American or other news reports. There's going to be no end of battery research going on. Lithium ion and lithium polymer batteries are really doing great things. My son and I visited a show called NEAT, N-E-A-T, Northeast Aero Technology, that took place in Schinhoppel, New York, last weekend. And that was a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday event. And these are people who fly battery-operated radio control model airplanes. And they run as high as 30 kilowatts of power. I mean, these guys are really packing it in with some very expensive lithium polymer batteries, and they're running airplanes that weigh as much as 30 pounds, move as much as 200 miles an hour, and these are radio control model aircraft. And not very many years ago, that would be called a remotely piloted vehicle, a weapon. And these things can... one of those aircraft, for instance, we watched it take off from the ground, climb straight up, and go out of sight in approximately 8 seconds. These things have got climb rates of like 2,000 feet per minute. Really, really high power machines you can get with batteries these days. Brushless DC motors fed with some very fancy electronics. And so the day of an internal combustion engine spitting out a whole lot of castor oil, that's the lubricant that gets sprayed all over the wings of the airplane. You got to spend the next 10 minutes after flying it wiping all the castor oil off and putting up with the noise, even though you got mufflers. Those days are gone. These electric-powered airplanes running on batteries, very modern, high-capacity batteries. Or you watch some of these very high-power helicopters do some of their maneuvers, radio-control, electrically-powered helicopters. You suddenly realize that the batteries are really coming a long way in the last few years. And although getting enough energy in batteries to run an automobile and drive it beyond 100 miles seems to be kind of a sound barrier. To get beyond 100 miles with an automobile is tough. The gas on my Toyota four-door sedan automobile, 1999 vintage, what is it, Camry, I think it is, if I fill up the tank and drive it all the way to the bottom, I can go 450 miles. It's going to be a long time before you can do that on batteries. We're anywhere near that amount of weight of fuel that runs it, so to speak. But we're moving in that direction. So you're going to be hearing more and more about batteries. Back to you, Frank. Obviously, we couldn't help you a great deal on this one. You probably are trying to select a battery to run your equipment in a portable manner. And you know how to calculate watts of... And hours that you're going to get out of that battery, and to get the kind of power you'd like if you're not a QRP operator, for the number of hours you like, as you can see, is a little bit on the difficult side. N2RSO, with a little bit of delay, if anyone else has any further information on nanophosphate battery, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Maybe I can help him a little bit.
Go right ahead, Frank. I mean, Mel.
Okay, if you look in September issue of QFT, you'll see two interesting, very interesting articles on. One is about battery charging, gel cell battery charger, and how to make one, and also a gadget that is marketed that, what do they call this thing here? It's a, it's a charger, it's a battery analyzer, power analyzer for charging systems, a little add-on that you put across the system, and it tells you, you know, how your battery conditioning is as far as charging, also discharging. They also have another thing on page 55, I see here, experiment number 80, SAP, and he lists a whole bunch of different kinds of battery sizes and everything, and their chemistry, and what you can expect as their nominal capacity based on milliampere hours. I wonder if you saw any of that, Dick, over.
No, I don't remember seeing that, and I should. Maybe I didn't study that issue very much. Part of what's going on here, some of these batteries, lithium-type batteries, either the anode or the cathode, are using carbon nanotubes coated with various pieces of chemistry, lithium or phosphate or whatever. Part of what's going on with the battery that allows you to have more ampere hours is that each individual plate, whether it be the positive plates or the negative plates, you want to give them a lot of microscopic hills and valleys, so to speak, so they've got a whole lot of area. That's part of what goes on with a lead-acid battery in your automobile. The brand-new battery's got a lot of area to each one of those plates. Unfortunately, if you discharge a lead-acid battery from your automobile beyond approximately 50% of its ampere hours, you're eventually starting to electroplate away all of those microscopic hills and valleys. Therefore, the next time you charge the battery, you don't have as much area, and you don't have as many watt-hours or ampere-hours anymore. That's part of what goes on with a car battery when you discharge it all the way and leave it in that charge state for a while. I know you had some more you wanted to say here, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, roger. Yeah, I guess the good old lead-acid battery still had a lot to say for itself, especially the ones that they mentioned here, that some of them could really be, really take a beating. They're specifically designed not for peak, high current peak output, like for a car battery to start the car and then that's it. But these are batteries that will be able to be drained at a constant rate and be pulled way down, such as they use in golf carts and things of that sort, and then be recharged up at a fairly heavy rate. And, well, like I say, we got the September issue of QST. Look at page 55, as one article there on battery capacity. Very interesting way that batteries are now, you know, being tested, and also what to look for, you know, depending on what your application is going to be. But the lithium ion battery, and there's a number of different lithium ion batteries, including this new MAC system called the MAC, I think they call it MAP system. I think I just saw it in fact mentioned. Is only one of a number of different batteries that's coming online, and they expect, in fact, there was a whole program that was done that Toyota expects that maybe within 10 years to stop producing actually a gas-driven car, Dick, over.
Something fun to look forward to. When I look at Frank's QRZ.com website, so to speak, and 2RSO, I see that you're a member of quite a few clubs, and you've also had quite a bit of experience with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the U.S. Army Security Agency. Anybody involved with emergency communications is going to eventually be at least temporarily dependent on batteries. I suspect that you're starting to do quite a bit of research on this subject, Frank. Kind of curious as to what is your immediate application, if there is one. But as you dig into batteries, which one gives you the best bang for the dollar, so to speak, sure hope you will come back periodically and let us know what you discover, because it sounds to me like you're about to dig pretty deep into it. Let's see what Frank's got to say on all of the above. N2RSO, K2RIW, you got it, Frank.
K2RIW, N2RSO returning. Okay, Dick, thank you, and thank you, Mel. And, yeah, currently for backup communications and for Aries use, I have one of those Blue Top Optima batteries. It's a deep cycle battery. And I also have a small solar charger that I really have not been able to implement yet. I just picked up a controller. And, yeah, we'll let you know when, as soon as I test all that and find out what's happening with it. In the meantime, I did a little more research, and it seems that the A123 company has its own website, www.a123systems.com, and they talk about the nanotechnology, the nanophosphate technology, more specifically. And just to give you an idea of the price of these things, the Buddy Pole company, that's the Bud Drummond's company, N3FF, he's selling the 2.3 amp hour battery pack for $95. That's that ain't cheap. the weight is remarkably light. It's only 13 ounces. And his other one, the higher capacity, 4.6 amp hour, is $165. And that's 23 ounces, the package weight. So it looks like we're going to have quite a few options there in the future as this technology evolves, and I'm sure these packs will get cheaper and cheaper. So, okay, thank you again, and back to Ned and to RSO.
As I see it, Frank, you helped us more than we helped you, but you're spreading the information. And those batteries are a little bit pricey, quite pricey, but they've got a lot of bang for the pound, as I see it. Looks like they're rather high energy density batteries. And like you said, hopefully when they go into, assuming that the technology proves itself to be having some real longevity to it and being reliable, will eventually be in higher production, and therefore by the scale, size of mass production, they'll get cheaper. So I know we haven't heard the end of batteries yet. They're going to be going on and on, battery research, because we'd all like to have methods of storing electrical energy. We'd all like to have portable equipment that can run for long and longer periods of time. Next person who signed in was all of a sudden my mind's gone blank. Our Limark official into our, here we go, W2OSR. Hey, Bob. Mr. Secretary, terrible. Go ahead with your multiple questions. You got it, Bob.
Okay, Dick, W2OSR. Well, I'm just out of the hospital. I was in for a week. I had a gallbladder removed. That's not the problem. They kept me an extra day because of blood pressure. I know it's a problem you've dealt with. So I don't know if you've got any references where I can start looking up guidelines for low-salt and low-fat diets. That's the first question. The second one is I've got a set of M-square 2-meter halos that I want to put in the stack. I'm trying to find out what's the best distance to have them apart, and also how do I match the two of them together if I wind up with 50 ohms at the feed point.
I think you turned it back to me, Frank. Your audio is a little bit lower than normal. I'm not quite sure what's going on. When it comes to the proper stacking distance for M-squared 2-meter halos, the best way I can think of doing that is either following the manufacturer's recommendation is a good beginning. And if you do or don't sign into the technical, here we go, what's it called, the WA1MBA, the WA1 Mike Bravo Alpha Microwave Reflector. I had an article I put on there a couple of days ago about proper stacking distance of Yagi antenna Yagi antennas that are on different bands. And in that particular case, you do not stack them, in my opinion, at the distance which is the sum of the individual areas, so to speak. Because when you're on 2 meters, that 432 Yagi has got some very little area, and vice versa. But the area of a Yagi is only on its design frequency. And when you're off the design frequency, even if you're on the third harmonic, like if you take a 2 meter Yagi and feed it on 432, you get nowhere near the same gain for a whole lot of complicated reasons, even though there's an exact 3-to-1 frequency relationship. So people often misunderstand that. The good news about a halo is that it's a relatively lower gain omnidirectional antenna, and I wouldn't be a bit surprised to find that the right stacking distance on 2 meters is in the vicinity of 4 or 5 feet. But once we know the gain of the antenna, I can estimate the area. Once we estimate the area, we can estimate the diameter of that area. And the usual stacking distance is such that the two circles of area just barely kiss each other or have a very slight overlap. And the compromise there is that as you stack further, you pick up a little bit more gain, but the antenna pattern gets more complicated. When you increase the vertical stacking, your vertical main lobe gets more narrow, and a bunch of side lobes start coming in, which could give you a little bit of grief. Now let me drop for your second question. Now I did find a website which will give you quite a bit of information on the subject of what I call mature onset sodium sensitivity. A certain percentage of the population at say age 45, 55, 60 suddenly runs into a condition where the amount of sodium, which really means salt in most cases, the amount of sodium in their diet can have a huge impact on health and specifically blood pressure. I went through an episode approximately 1 year ago today, August 31st, I went through an episode where I had eaten a very heavily salted meal. It was the second day in a row I had done that, and I ended up with some pretty nasty symptoms of very high blood pressure and ended up in the emergency room of Huntington Hospital. And unfortunately, my physicians, cardiologists and regular physicians, primary care physicians, never specifically recommended that I go on a low-sodium diet, which kind of amazed me. I decided that, hey, that was the common denominator because the whole event in my case repeated 2 days later, and I was back in the emergency room again. And I said, hey, what's the common denominator here? And in both cases, 6 hours earlier, I had eaten a tremendous amount of salt, and my body was reacting to it. And I suddenly realized that I have a family history of that, that a number of members of my family suffered terribly from water retention, high blood pressure, and other side effects of sodium intake. When you study the labels on our packaged foods, you'll discover a tremendous amount of salt that's there that doesn't have to be there. They think the American diet has built up a liking for salt and the flavoring of salt. It does add extra flavor to food, no two ways about it. But it's got some nasty side effects. The American Medical Association in the January issue of Consumers Report had an article that talked about the amount of sodium in our foods, but the AMA said that if the food packagers would lower the sodium that's in our food, 150,000 Americans per year would not die of coronary conditions that are being aggravated by the salt input. As you start going on a low-salt diet, which most likely you're going to do, at first you're going to suffer a little bit. You're going to say, gee, my food doesn't taste as good. Well, there are a number of salt substitutes, and also once you get used to it, you'll discover...
Repeater, time out.
Once you get used to it, you'll discover that there you didn't have as much need for salt as you think you did, and you're going to study the labels. I used to think the safest thing in the world was Cheerios and Raisin Bran, my favorite cereals in the morning. I don't eat them anymore. I think one serving of Raisin Bran, Kellogg's Raisin Bran, I think it is, has got 450 milligrams just for that one meal. The American diet recommendation is 2,500 per day milligrams. In my opinion, that is way too high. I think 500 to 700 is all the body really needs. Anything more than that can get you into trouble. I'm pretty sure I've got your website, your email address, and I can find it by QRZ.com. When I refine this particular website that you're going to go to, you'll get quite a bit of information. So that'll help. It's a continuing, struggling battle. Only a certain percentage of the population has the problem. I mean, if everybody lowered their salt intake, some people would experience a tremendous improvement. Some people would experience no improvement at all. Part of what's going on is the so-called sodium to calcium ratio. If there's enough calcium in your diet from places like broccoli and bananas and whatever, the body can tolerate a higher amount of salt. I said calcium. I think I got that right. Yeah, I think it's calcium. I may be wrong on the particular mineral, but I'll eventually straighten that one out. I'll be giving you a website on this one, Bob. And so sodium is more detrimental than beneficial. If you're a person that does a whole lot of physical exercise and a whole lot of sweating, yes, you may have to add extra salt to your diet. But not very many of us fall into that category anymore. We don't do that much physical labor. And so therefore, the extra salt can get us into trouble. W2OSR, K2LIW.
K2KEY, what a little comment on this.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, coming from a similar background with people in my family that really suffered with high blood pressure and the poor diet that they had, I am particularly been very careful a good part of my life to watch my diet. And one of the questions I had for my doctor about the salt intake, and he says, believe it or not, he says the worst time or the worst offender of a person getting too much salt into their diet starts out with breakfast, because at that point most of us haven't eaten for many hours. So that when we get these breakfast cereals, especially that are so loaded with salt, the absorption rate is phenomenally high. So he said this seems to be the biggest offender right now, is to get these manufacturers of breakfast cereals to knock down the salt. They are, they feel that because of the children, you know, getting the high salt doesn't make much of a effect on them, and they feel it. But of course, we're looking into that in another direction, but they don't seem to, you know, care about whether the adults are getting the same amount of salt as their kids in the cereal they go over.
Yeah, I said something wrong before, and I'm going to correct it now. It's the sodium potassium ratio, not calcium, potassium. You're supposed to have three times as much potassium as sodium in your diet, in which case the kidneys, with the right ratio of potassium to sodium, your kidneys can properly handle the extra water retention and tolerate the sodium and dump it correctly. Without the proper potassium to sodium ratio, the kidneys, unless you have an extremely strong constitution, can't really balance these things out. You end up with water retention, you end up with a swollen ankle, swollen feet, high blood pressure, and things like that. So the website you want to go to is called Alvin Hopkinson. Alvin Hopkinson. That's his web address. If you just Google that particular set of words, you'll get his email address. In fact, I just found a good one here. The actual web address, that's the name that goes in parentheses, if you know what I mean, in quotes. But the actual website itself is contact@minusbloodpressure.com. So it's contact@minusbloodpressure.com, all run together. Let's see if the minus is spelled correctly. MINUSBLOODPRESSURE. Yes. So contact@minusbloodpressure.com, the Alvin Hopkinson site. A fairly good one. He sells a number of books on the subject that are reasonably well written.
Net tonight.
He also has
8 o'clock. Net tonight at 8 o'clock.
I think it was his website that I got this beautiful $20 book from. It's a large format, 8.5 by 11 book, which lists every one of the popular pharmaceuticals that our physicians are issuing these days. One of the things that I'm very disappointed about is that I discovered that the majority of physicians these days have a knee-jerk reaction to prescribe all kinds of heavy, expensive pharmaceuticals for every one of these conditions. And anything you can do, in my opinion, to correct the condition without the pharmaceuticals, and the pharmaceuticals are all in their second and third and fourth generation, and therefore they've all built up some ridiculously high side effects. And when you read that particular book on, I think the title of the book used to be America's worst pharmaceuticals and most popular pharmaceuticals, something like that was the title. I'll be sending you some information on this one, Bob.